Assuming either Steve or Chris, right?
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
About the two amendments.
Oh, good. Senate Tax Conference Committee to order on House File 848. Members.
I updated the House. Okay.
The first thing to start out in good faith is I'm going to give my counterpart in the Senate, Chair Skoy, a Minnesota product, a Pearson salted nut roll that says, get her done.
Get her done. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm with you on let's get her done.
So each of the members, if you have one.
Oh, wow. I love it.
Larry the cable guy.
And you know, Mr. Chair, we have a sales tax exemption for some of this Larry the fiber cable guy.
We'll be talking about Larry
the cable guy.
Now, I'm actually a couple short, so we're going to go sweet. And we're going to go, or excuse me, Representative Swazinski. We're going to go there, and then who doesn't have one?
I think we all have
I think
one.
No.
I've got my jelly right.
That's for you.
No.
And then the commissioner gets one.
We can share. We'll share.
Mr. Chairman, I only have one left, and I'd like you to have it.
Oh. Mr. Chair.
Sometimes I just have to live with disappointment.
Happy to be a resource.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, in order to keep the environment sweetened up here, we have some chocolate chip cookies that are in the back of the room. So for anybody who has a hankering.
I'll be there.
Oh.
Our intern Beth made them.
That is very good. Very good.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Okay, members, if you look at the agenda, I'm going to make a couple additions to the agenda. The gentleman from Lyon has a provision he'd like to visit about for a little bit. And then Chair Lencheski has two provisions that we'll visit about a little bit. Of course, we're not taking action on any items. We just want to make sure we go over these so when we get the green light, we can get going right away. And then the gentleman from Lyon, Chair Lencheski, has a couple items. And then, of course, we'll open up for discussion or anything. We'll just start at the top, members. Let's go to the Angel Investor Credit, item number one. And if we can kind of go through the format, who has that from House Research? Is that Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi?
Do I have a copy of this?
Chocolate chips.
Is there a bubble?
Hey, welcome to the conference committee, Ms. Manzi. If you could describe the House provision, Article 1, Sections 3 and 4, Angel Investor Credit.
St. Paul, Minnesota. Just on 7th.
Get her down. Okay. Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, the House provisions on the Angel Investment Credit increase the allocation from $15 million to $18 million for tax years 2015 and 2016, and then extends the $18 million allocation to tax years 2017 and 2018. It reserves 50% of the available amount for investments in Greater Minnesota and women and minority-owned businesses, as was implemented last year. And then the second section simply extends the subdivision of the Angel Credit Statute that contains the sunset to accommodate the extension to two additional tax years.
Okay, questions for members on number one? Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Manzi, do you have in your notes what the current balances are in these two funds? My recollection says just over $4 million in one and just under $4 million in the other.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, that's correct. As of May 12th, so earlier this week, the balance in the $7.5 million reserved for Greater Minnesota and women and minority-owned businesses was $4.7 million out of the $7.5 million reserved. And the balance in sort of the general pool, which started out the year at $8.5 million due to $1 million of cancellations in the previous year, was $3.3 million.
And Senator Skoy?
Ms. Manzi, when would without any changes in law, when would those funds be replenished?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, after September 30th, if the Greater Minnesota and women and minority-owned business, $4.7 million remaining, had not been allocated, then it would go to the general pool for any applications that were outstanding. And the additional amount, the new allocation of $15 million, would be available in January of 2016.
Chairman Skoy.
Thank you.
Questions for members to the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We understand this program has provided some beneficial investment for companies around the state, and we don't have any concerns with the way it's written or the extension of the additional funding.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Item 2, first responder meals. I'll take that one. That one is in Article 1, Section 11. And it's very simply what that does is that allows a – is that yours too, Ms. Manzi?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, there's just an amendment to this that incorporates the suggestions recommended by the Department of Revenue in their memo. So you were doing fine at explaining the provision. So
okay, let's go to the amendment in the shape we needed as recommended by the department here. Chair Rest moves the H0848A128 amendment. Any discussion? And again, we're not moving this, we're just amending a current provision. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
We've been commenting provisionally on those, so okay. It helps the staff with their.
Okay, provisionally, the amendments provisionally put on. Okay, Ms. Manzi, as amended.
Mr. Chair, as amended, this provision allows individuals who serve as first responders to deduct from taxable income a meal allowance for unreimbursed meal expenses. This was a provision of Representative Neuberger's, who is aware that first responders often aren't able to bring food with them. You're not allowed to have food inside of the first response vehicle, the ambulance or something like that. So they pretty much have to go buy their meals out, and that was his interest in this provision. The amount is, it depends on how many days that you're on call as a first responder. So if you're on call for up to 20 hours per week, then your subtraction for that week is $7.50 for 2 days in the week. So it's $15 a week for a week when you're on call for up to 20 hours. And if you're on call for more than 20 hours, then your subtraction is for $7.50 days a week for 4 days in the week, or $30. And you would, you know, keep track of how many hours you were on call each week of the year, and then you would be deemed to have meal expenses for those amounts for that year.
Questions for members? To the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate the committee taking up the amendment to clarify.
Further discussion? Okay, we will go to item next. Number 2 there was provisionally amended. 3, dependent care credit. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, there are no amendments to this provision. I don't think the department recommended any changes. This provision has the language structure that the governor proposed to the Conference Committee on Taxes last year. It begins the phase out at a lower income level. It would start the phase out of the dependent care credit, which under current law is fully phased out at around $39,000. Under this proposal, it would instead start to phase out when income reached $44,000. It would be fully phased out for a person claiming the credit for one dependent at $56,000 of income, and for a person claiming the credit for two or more dependents at $68,000 of income. So it extends the income eligibility to a broader range than what's allowed under current law.
Questions on dependent care credit from members? Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the members, I see the governor's cost on this is $104 million in 2015, and the House scales that back to a biennial cost of $35
million. That's correct.
$35 million.
That is a loan provision, Chairman.
Mr. Chair, this is a modified version of the bill that Representative Loon had. Hers would have started the phase out at $70,000 of income and had a higher revenue impact than what's carried in House File 848. The governor's proposal would have started the phase out at $100,000 of income, and that's why it has the cost that Senator Skoy referenced.
Thanks, Ms. Manzi. To the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We do appreciate the expansion of this credit being included in the House bill, and the only suggestion the department would have is that we add to it to get closer to the governor's proposal to approach more middle, to allow more middle-class families to access this credit. Thank you.
Thank you, and I would say that, Commissioner Bowerly, you worked very hard on this. You traveled the state on this, and we met in Rochester at that some months ago now, and thank you for your work on this.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for joining us in Rochester. It was an entertaining day with four-year-olds. It doesn't quite compare to tax committee, though.
I came to the conclusion after that meeting, Commissioner Bowerly, that there's a reason why you have children when you're young. There is a reason. There is a reason for that. Item next, item four, long-term care credit. Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, actually the amendment that's being distributed goes with the next item, the long-term care savings plan. There is no amendment for the long-term care credit. The long-term care credit proposal in the House bill would increase the rate of the credit from 25% to 50% and would increase the maximum credit from $100 to $150. The way the credit works under current law is that it's 25% of premiums paid up to a maximum credit of $100. So you have to have premiums of at least $400 to get the maximum credit of $100. A married couple filing jointly who both have policies could each spouse could claim the credit, and that would remain the case under the proposal. The proposal would both increase the credit amount allowed per policy, and it would decrease the amount of premiums that's necessary to pay to reach the maximum credit. This is a non-refundable credit.
Okay, questions from members on item four. Senator Gonzalez.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the revenue note on that? How much did it cost?
We've got it right here. Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gazalka, it's $9.5 million for the 16-17 biennium.
Right, thank you.
Senator Gazalka. Good. Okay, I believe that was an O'Driscoll bill. Okay, questions from members? We'll go to the department. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, as it relates to long-term care, I think the administration shares the sort of thought about how we can think about this problem. And I know that there's been many discussions that have been had in the HHS committee about how to do this. But as it relates to the tax credit, to think about if this is the best tool in which to do that. So if you look at some of the analyses, there's been some studies done. There's been some overviews done. I know that House Research has looked at a number of studies. And they found that the cost of credits and deductions exceed the savings realized in state and federal spending on Medicaid programs. I'll just highlight two or three. Kramer, Jensen, and Why Don't People Buy Long-Term Care Insurance found that price was a small but significant factor in the decision to purchase long-term care insurance. And they said a 25% discount in price, a credit, would increase purchases by maybe half a percentage point. David Nixon in State Programs to Encourage Long-Term Care Insurance found no statistical significant relationship between availability of state tax incentives and the purchase of long-term care insurance. Another study by Cortemanche and Daifang He, tax incentives in the decision to purchase long-term care insurance, found that the federal itemized deduction for long-term care insurance increased the take-up rate for long-term care insurance by 3.3 percentage points, but the net effect was the reduced revenue by $187 and reduced Medicaid spending by $91. Thus, for every dollar of tax expenditure, 49 cents of Medicaid savings were realized. So as we're looking at this broad discussion of how we use state resources to try and get at public outcomes, you know, there are studies out there that are just trying to look at this relationship. So having a broader discussion between this committee and the Health and Human Services Committee is helpful, especially on this topic. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Other questions from members on item 4? Okay, with that, we will go to item 5, and to get the provision in the shape we would like, Representative Coonan. Excuse me, Senator Coonan, are we on the...
Ms. Manns would be the 127?
Yes.
Well, all House members except Kerry.
Yeah, I remember Representative Coonan.
Yeah.
Pretty good guy.
Yeah. Still is.
Still is, okay. I better just get to the amendment here. Senator Coonan moves A127 to get the provision provisionally in the shape we would like. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Manzi, as amended, what did we just do?
Mr. Chair, the long-term care savings plan provisions in the House bill appear in three different sections of the bill. The first section sets up the plans and provides the various terms used in the plans. These plans would be accounts that people would make contributions to, and then the earnings, the amounts in the accounts would grow free of state tax while they were invested in the accounts, and people could make withdrawals to either pay for their long-term care expenses or to buy long-term care insurance premiums. In the event an individual owned an account and died, then the account could be transferred to the spouse. And so that's how the accounts would work. And then there is a subtraction from taxable income for contributions to the long-term care savings plans of up to $1,000 for single filers and $2,000 for married joint filers, and that would be each year. There also is that's the last of the three sections. The middle section is an addition to taxable income, which would come into play in the case an individual made an unauthorized withdrawal from the account. They would then have to add to taxable income the amount that was withdrawn.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Before we go to questions from members, I've been given an instruction here that members, we could please talk right into the microphone, because when it goes on TV, I guess they're having some trouble hearing us. They said the only one they could hear was me. I don't know if that just means I'm loud or what. So on item 5, as amended, questions from members. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might not be related to this, but I had a relative that died recently, and they had long-term care insurance. They had been paying for long-term, what they viewed was a long-term care plan, and they purchased and paid regular payments for long-term plan insurance. So then he gets sick, and they go to ask for help, and they're told, well, the long-term care insurance plan, and it might just be a bad plan that they had and they were sold, but the long-term plan insurance had to, you know, doesn't kick in until they get into hospice. And then once, and it's like X amount of days after they get into hospice. Well, I think it was 30 or 60 days after he gets into hospice is when the plan kicked in. well, you're going into hospice, lots of times you might not last for 30 to 60 days. So they put in all this money in a plan, and I'm wondering if how these two, you know, would these two help that? And so is it maybe better for Minnesotans sure. to do a long-term care saving plan like this, or is this an insurance plan that, again, may or may not help them? And I've heard that this is quite common.
Well, Senator Disick, to that point, I would hope it's not quite common, although there are some older plans out there that have very limited benefit sets, I would say. The new partnership plans, that wouldn't happen. You'd get into any type of long-term care, whether it be in-home daycare, nursing home, hospice, whatever, and then whatever, however many days you pick, if it's 30 days, some are 90, some are 180, some financial planners will do a year because they have other assets to take care of it. So there are some old bad plans out there that would not be partnership plans, and this is kind of my business, and you make sure that people, first of all, know what they have, and then if you can upgrade it, you certainly want to do that. So Senator Gazelka?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Disick, I was going to say the same thing, other than, you know, you might have a little longer waiting period where they don't get it right away, but Representative Davids is right. But I do have a question on this particular provision. Can somebody make a contribution for someone else? Is that considered a deductible expense? I'm thinking about, for example, either kids for parents or parents for kids, parents being like a 85-year-old that said, I wish I had it, and they do it for their 55-year-old. Is that part of this at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I know that on the coming out part, you can only make the withdrawal for expenses that are for yourself or your spouse. Okay. Mr. Michael was more involved in drafting this, and I neglected to bring the actual bill language up with me, so if he could maybe answer that part of it.
Mr. Michael? That's a very good question. If somebody else puts it for somebody else, could they take the deduction or... Well, he's looking at that. Yeah. Senator Dietzick, after we finish with Senator Gazelka, I'll go back to you. I didn't know if he was done. I'm sorry, I just went over to him.
Thank you. I was just kind of pointing it out because I didn't know how this plan would interact with an insurance plan that, you know, may or may not be good. So, again, it's just to tell everybody out there, if anybody has, you know, changed from ESPN and is now watching us, that, you know, if they have a plan, they should find out if it is viable and they should read the fine print because... You know, I hope that they are not in the situation where my relative was, where it didn't work.
And Senator Dietzick, on number five, that's not actually like a long-term care policy. It's a long-term care savings plan where you can put money away so that if you need, you can pull out of there, or you can use it to pay premiums for an actual long-term care policy.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, in this long-term care savings plan that's proposed, there wouldn't be any waiting period before you could make withdrawals to actually pay for expenses. So if these plans came into existence and someone had one, they would be able to use a withdrawal from it for their first day of qualifying expenses.
And I believe this was a Chair Schumacher plan.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Michael?
Nobody's done that.
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that. I can't, and I cannot find in the language something that clearly resolves it. The language limits who the withdrawals can benefit, but it's, as far as I can tell, it's silent about the. And I think you can, you know, you could always accomplish what you want to. Well. Not exactly which, but you can always make a gift to somebody who then makes the contribution, but if they don't have enough taxable income to benefit from it, you not get the tax benefit.
Sorry, results. Okay. On item five, Chair Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to you or to Ms. Manzi. Do four and five, either one of them stand on their own, or are those two running kind of together?
Chair Skoy, they stand on their own.
They stand on their own.
They could... Either one or neither.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, to the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did sort of outline of some broader just thoughts about long-term care. So,
thank you, Mr. Cummings. Let's go to item six. I'll start out with that, and then Ms. Manzi, if you could correct anything that I say that's not correct. Okay, charity healthcare. This was a Grunhagen provision, and what he's doing here, what this bill does, and I think it's about $3.7 million for the biennium. This one really intrigued me in that a lot of dentists and doctors will not take Medicaid patients anymore because the reimbursement rates are so low. So to try and get them to take that population, what the doctor or dentist could do would provide the care. He knows he's not going to get paid on it, he or she. And so then they can deduct the value of their services according to Medicaid rates.
Yeah,
and they can deduct that amount from their taxable income. How'd I do?
Very well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I would like to
add something.
I would, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, the department made some recommendations with regard to this. We don't quite have the amendment drafted, but maybe we'll have it for you later today. It makes, I think, three changes. The first change is there's a section early in the bill which provides for information reporting by the medical professional to the Department of Revenue on how much of this charity care they provided during the year. And that provision was lacking a due date for the information return, so we've added a due date of February 15th of the year following the taxable year in which the services were provided. That section also requires the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner of Revenue, to develop a definition of charity health care services. And the department's administrative memo noted that the commissioner lacked the expertise to do that, and we added some language authorizing the commissioner to consult with the commissioner of health, who would probably have more expertise in that area. The final change was to the actual subtraction, in which the department suggested that we limit the subtraction to amounts of charity care provided for which the medical professional was not reimbursed under Medicare. And so those three things will be in the amendment that, with any luck, we'll have for you later today.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Vance. We can come back to that later today or tomorrow. Yep. Mm-hmm. Questions? Vice Chair Barrett?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, I would imagine the credit for the care given applies to care given in the state of Minnesota. I know a lot of doctors go down to various countries and do charity care, which is very noble, but wondering if there is any provision limiting it to Minnesota care.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, again, when I came up here, I neglected to bring my copy of the bill with me, so I'd have to look at that. That's something that we could certainly add to the amendment. I think the intent was to limit it to care provided in Minnesota, and I think that the Department of Revenue's estimate for this item was restricted to care provided in Minnesota. So I'll take a look at that, and if it isn't in the amendment, then we'll add that.
And Vice Chair Barrett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi. Yeah, I'm not sure what the committee here would think would be appropriate, but just was more of a question, yep, more than anything, to see regarding the fiscal note, whether that included all care or just Minnesota care.
Vice Chair Barrett, that is a very good point. And Ms. Manzi, you can kind of follow up and make sure, because, yep, the intention from the author is that it's care given to Minnesotans in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, based on the conversations in the various committees, and this went to at least one, if not both, of the Health and Human Services Committee. I can't recall if it was in both of them or just one. There was nothing in the discussion anywhere about having it be for the missions to other countries. Let's see.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. And Ms. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, Ms. Templin.
The revenue estimate for this bill did limit the reimbursement to the reimbursement rates. So it is to.
Yep.
The estimate just covers Minnesota.
Okay, thank you for that. Chair Skoy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi. I'm not sure that I know what the differential between charity care and uncompensated care is. And so I'm thinking about a hospital scenario where there's a patient comes in, gets treatment, and the hospital calls that uncompensated care. Is that charity care? Would that be just for the doctor that provided the service and not for the hospital charge? I'm trying to understand what the definitional differences are.
Ms. Manzi?
I know this is kind of not the Health and Human Services Committee, so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, this subtraction would be allowed only for the medical professional. So it would be a doctor, a dentist. It also would apply to chiropractors and acupuncturists to the extent the service provided is within the scope of their practice and is reimbursable to them under Medicare. Yeah, reimbursable under medical assistance and for which a federal Medicaid match is available. So it would be limited to
those procedures,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And the medical provider might not know at the time that he's providing the service that this was going to be available because he wouldn't know if he's going to be reimbursed or not.
Ms. Banzi?
Mr. Chair, I think, well, that is correct that the provider might not know that. The testimony that we had from medical professionals who currently provide charity care certainly convey the sense that they often know that they're providing care to an individual who doesn't have any insurance and isn't going to be able to reimburse them, but there certainly might be cases where they weren't aware of that.
And Chairman, one more. And can I think about this in the same definition of uncompensated care? Is that comparable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, it wouldn't include, like, the hospital expenses and things like that that you were describing. It would just be the amount that the medical professional themselves would be eligible to be reimbursed for.
Questions for members? General from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think mine's probably just more a comment of clarification. I think the impetus would be less, where Chairman Scoy would be going is more kind of on the emergency room show. And this would be, I think the impetus, I think this was Representative Grunhagen's yep. provision. And this, his idea was more along the, you know, you're doing a care from more of a dental profession where someone's coming in. It's not necessarily an emergency procedure. Or I think maybe you're trying to draw some of those things together. I think that's where it's kind of moving towards a little bit more than from an emergency procedure standpoint.
Sure. But from what I heard, the other would also qualify for the health care provider component only.
General from Lyon?
Just from
Okay. Let's go to the department. Commissioner Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, I'd like to note we appreciate the sentiment behind this proposal, and we really do appreciate being able to work through some of the definitional issues that are presented in the current draft, and appreciate the work of Ms. Manzi in particular in working with the department on that. As we noted in our administrative memo, the items that we identified in there were necessary to or would be helpful in making any provision administrable, but we still have policy concerns about how this fits in with perhaps other professional services that are provided on a charitable basis. Generally, under federal law, the value of time is not deductible. It's goods, usually goods that are when they're donated, and you can calculate the time. So this would be different than federal policy. And also, this would be a challenging area for us to ensure compliance with your statute, because if we had a provider who came in with a significant claim for this kind of tax relief, and we saw some anomalies with the paperwork or the documentation, and we needed to ask follow-up questions, HIPAA and other healthcare privacy provisions may make that difficult. So I just wanted to note that we appreciate the work to help add definitions, and we'll work towards making this administrable, but we still have concerns about the nature of this provision. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions from members? Okay, let's go to item next, 7, credit for teachers who get master's degrees. There'd be a tax credit on number 7, Article 1, 29, Section 29 of the House bill. And we have an amendment. What this provision does is it allows a credit for teachers who are getting master's degrees in their area of licensure. This is an ERDL provision, this is a Senator Rest provision, fine piece of legislation. And so, Ms. Manzi, any other thoughts on this one that I missed?
Mr. Chair, the amendment would address a concern raised by the department that they suggested that the language should require the teacher to be holding a license both at the time they begin the master's degree program and at the time they complete the master's degree program, and that's what the amendment does.
Okay, so let's get that amendment on provisionally here. Senator Gazelka moves the H0848A. I think Chair Resch should move this one. Moves the H0848A122 amendment. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails provisionally to put this on item one, Article 1, Section 29. Further questions, sir? Ms. Matthew, do you have anything else to say on this one?
Mr. Chair, I guess the only other thing I would note is that the way this is written, it has a time lag to sort of reflect the fact that it generally would take people 2 years to finish a master's degree. So this credit would apply to degrees that were begun after June 30th, 2015. And then as it ramps up, if there were someone who managed to complete their master's degree before tax year 2017, they would have to wait to claim the credit until tax year 2017, so that if there were people who were doing accelerated programs, you wouldn't have a handful of them claiming the credit in the initial years in which it was in effect.
Any questions for members? Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, I'm curious about the definition of beginning a program after June 30th, 2015, as it relates to situations in which people have a license through classwork, don't quite get to the master's level, need a few classes left over to get their master's. Would their program have begun prior to June 30th or July 1st, June 30th, 2015 in that situation?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, I'm not that familiar with the master's degrees programs for teachers in their areas. Generally, if they had started a formal program through a college or university before June 30th, 2015, then they would not qualify for the credit. They would have to start the program after June 30th. I think the intent of the author was try to make this an incentive for people who maybe weren't otherwise considering starting a program, and he also was concerned with controlling the revenue impact of it.
Sure. Vice Chair Barrett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Manzi. I think, and I don't know to what extent this happens, but I do know it happens in which teachers continue to increase their level of education and sometimes are within are within that, and I think that type of teacher might take advantage of this as well. But if it's not within the confines of the legislation, that's fine.
Questions for members? To the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and again, we appreciate the work to address the administrative concern that we raised in our memo and appreciate that work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. No. Item next, 8 NOLs, I believe, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There's an amendment for this that's being passed out that's an attempt to address some of the concerns expressed by the department about this provision.
Hey, Mr. Michael, let's put this on. Senator Gazelka moves the A125 amendment. Any questions on the amendment, provisional amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Michael, as amended.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, essentially what this provision of the House bill does is to provide a NOL, net operating loss refund program for emerging biotechnology and technology companies that are located in Minnesota. And it's got an allocation of $15 million per year. And essentially, each year, these qualifying companies, which have to be either biotech companies or technology companies with fewer than 250 employees, would apply to the commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for certification to essentially turn in their net operating losses and get a refund of the tax benefit back from the state to pay for that. What the amendment does is it clarifies, first of all, that this program is restricted to C corporations, which I believe was always the intent. In fact, it would be impossible to figure out what your tax benefit would be if you have an NOL, because if you were an individual, the tax rate would be zero. There is a flat corporate tax rate, so the assumption is that everybody pays at the top rate, and that's what the benefit would be. And it would be a little odd to have individuals surrendering NOLs at the corporate rate. So the amendment restricts it to the corporate rate, clarifies the department was concerned about how the loss year was terminology was, so the amendment fixes that. The department said they preferred that this be allocated on a first-come, first-served basis by the Department of Trade and Employment and Economic Development. So the amendment changes it to a first-come, first-served basis, whereas before the proposal allowed any of the small applicants to get funded and then apportion the amount for the larger applicants. But this would essentially put the $15 million out to the, based on who applies first. And, of course, the idea with this is to provide an incentive for those startup biotech, high-tech companies operating in Minnesota expand and so forth, similar to a refundable R&D credit or the angel credit.
Questions for members? Chair Skoy?
Well, I'll just briefly say that, we did have hearings on this, and there are other concerns, but one of the concerns is that there really is no way to identify if the loss is a good idea or a bad idea, and it's never going to amount to anything anyway. And so there's no mechanism in here to do any of the quality of the idea determination, so we had some concerns about it from that aspect.
Questions for members? The department?
Mr. Chair, Mr. members Cummings? Of the conference committee, net operating losses were really meant as a policy choice that were put in many years ago around the First World War. It was really to soften the blow between year to year. And so, but what they found after implementing the net operating losses is that people tried to make net operating losses into something else, really a transferable somehow monetary benefit. And so there was some net operating loss trafficking that would happen. Now, there were some tightening of the regulations that happened. And so we really have tried to make sure that this is something that is really softening the blow between year to year. But what this provision is doing is really making a policy choice to say that we should be giving taxpayer dollars back to a selected targeted group. And in some cases, we say that selected targeted group is for research and development. Sometimes we say small businesses. Sometimes we say businesses in Greater Minnesota. This policy choice is saying that this would be giving money directed at unprofitable businesses. Now, that might be the policy choice that that this committee wants to make, but it is really thinking about if we're trying to say that we should be refunding net operating loss, that is what we're doing. Now, this proposal has changed. Originally, it was more about transferring it, and now it is more akin to making some refundability. But the poster child for this has been New Jersey. And in New Jersey, there are other provisions. It's very tight in terms of the regulations about net operating losses. And then they also have other tax attributes that are helpful in thinking about those transactions between businesses, including economic substance. So as we talk about this provision, it's also important to talk about other important provisions like economic substance that was included in the governor's budget. So we appreciate the opportunity to bring forward some ideas related to this, and thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any follow-up questions from members? Yeah, item next, domicile, and there is an amendment that will be passed out to the House language here. And now the domicile issue is Article 1, Section 8 of the House, Article 1, Section 7 of the Senate. This amendment would be to the House provisions. And I believe, members, this is agreed-to language with the interested parties on the definition of financial advice. Or any questions before you put this on? Senator Gazelka?
I'll move it.
Senator Gazelka moves the H0848-8121 amendment provisionally. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now to the provision as provisionally amended.
Mr. Chairman, the reason we put this on the list was just to give the committee a chance to adopt this amendment to put the House bill in the form that we want to consider it. This has been discussed before, so I don't. Essentially, what the amendment does is to slightly modify the definition that's in the House bill to make it clear that financial institution entities, so it adds the term business entity, qualify as a definition of financial advisors. So it's not just the individuals who are certified financial planners, registered investment advisors, and so forth, but also the entities that employ them that would qualify.
Okay, to the department, I believe you were involved in this language.
Mr. Chairman, we have been involved in conversations about this provision and about the medical days provision. We were just consulting. We're not sure that we've seen the last subdivision, and so we just need a moment, if you don't mind. We're not sure this is the language that we had seen. We were comfortable with what was in the House bill. So if you might, could give us a moment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. In fact, I'll tell you, we'll keep going. We'll come back to this one.
Okay.
Because, yes, that's Mr. Michael.
Ask if there's a cost.
Mr. Chairman, I was not involved in those discussions. I believe that the interest groups were in the discussions, and I thought they had represented that the department was involved, and we were given language.
Just
so I really don't know.
Is this provision as amended or not have a revenue impact that's been scored,
Ms. Temple,
other than unknown?
Mr. Chair, and checking with House research staff, the opinion was that this is a technical change to the definition and that it wouldn't have a revenue impact. But we certainly could run it by revenue and double check.
Chair Rest, to the whole, Ms. Temple, and Chair Rest was referring to the whole provision.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, it has an unknown impact.
Chair Rest.
And, Mr. Chairman, with the addition of this amendment, it remains unknown. Is that correct?
Ms. Templin, we're still unknown?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Senator Gazelka?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I was talking to Commissioner Bowerly about this. The provision related to financial services has no revenue note. Is that correct?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman, I will leave it to the fiscal staff to talk about the revenue estimate with respect to the department's fiscal note for the cost of administration. We do not have a cost of administration on the financial advisor portion of the domicile changes.
And again, it's coming back to me now. We had met on this previously, so this is something we'll continue discussion on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, item next, 10 sales tax vendor allowance. Ms. Dalton. Thank you, Mr. Michael. Ms. Dalton, number 10.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the substance of this provision is actually in Section 29 on page 46 of the side-by-side. It basically provides a vendor allowance for sales tax collected as compensation for administrative costs. The allowance is 3% of the first $10,000 of sales tax remitted during a reporting period, and I don't know if I said that right, 0.3% of the tax remitted, and 0.15% of any tax remitted above $10,000 in that reporting period. It does not include use tax paid on the vendor's own purchases, and a vendor is only eligible for the allowance if they are in good standing and remitting as required under law.
Any questions on item 10, sales tax vendor allowance? Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe not a question, but a statement. As someone who used to, in a previous life, submit sales tax returns to various states, I know that it can be quite daunting and challenging and time-consuming. I know that in Minnesota used to be really easy. It used to be 6.5%, and it didn't take much time at all. But as we've gotten to city and county taxes, it becomes a little bit greater burden on the person and the organization submitting these tax returns, including audits, and have to be completed occasionally. So with that, I think having a vendor allowance, it's something that many other states do, and it seems appropriate for Minnesota to do that as we as it becomes a more complicated system to impose and collect taxes.
Questions for members? To the commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We don't have any concerns about administrability of this provision. We would just note that the cost that is associated with it, and that this, and up until this point, it hasn't it seemed necessary for retailers to do that. We do try to, I will tell you at the department, we do try to make this as easy as possible on retailers and providing them the information and the education that they need to be able to comply with the taxes, that the statutory tax obligations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Any follow-up questions? Chair Raskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the commissioner has received any, have you heard, commissioner, from any vendors throughout Minnesota, retailers, about the desire to have this? Have they called in the department at all?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman and Chair Joskowski, I have not personally heard from vendors, but before I would give you a complete answer, I'd like to check in with our division and who deal with those retailers every single day, and I'd like to have an opportunity to report back to you.
Chair Joskowski, thank you. Okay, item next, 11, off-road fuels exemption. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House has two provisions related to this. One on page 42 is Article 6, Section 2, and the other one is on page 44 of the side-by-side, and it's Section 17. Basically, Section 2 lists a number of uses of special fuels for off-road use. The department actually believes that this isn't necessary, that these uses of this fuel are already exempt from the motor fuels exemption. However, listing them here, they are then exempted from the sales tax in Section 17. If motor fuel is not paying, if gas and special fuels are not paying the motor fuels tax, they are subject to the sales tax unless it's explicitly excluded. The department actually would like to see Section 2 eliminated and the language from Section 2 actually put into Section 17, just enumerating the uses that would be exempt from the sales tax. I have not drafted the amendment, however.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Is this the Petersburg provision?
Yes.
Petersburg Rest?
No, just Petersburg.
Oh, okay.
I was just reading that.
Oh, okay. To the department, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, I think Ms. Dalton did a very good job at describing our comments related to this provision, and so we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, to try and get that resolved before passage.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any follow-up questions for members? Item next would be propane tank exemption. I believe that was the Baker a provision there. Ms. Dalton, please describe number 12, Article 6, Section 14.
Mr. Chair, that's on page 43 of the side-by-side, and it exempts sales propane tanks of 100 gallons or larger from sales tax, and it's a temporary exemption. It's effective the day after final enactment and expires December 2017. This bill was actually introduced last year, kind of during the height of a propane crisis, and it was in response of trying to get people to buy their own propane tanks, which essentially gets them out of the monopoly provision of if they're renting their tank, they must buy from the manufacturer that they're renting their tank from.
Okay, thank you. I believe this is in the Senate, the Senator Coonan provision on that. Okay, questions for members? Chair Skoy.
Thank you. And we, you did mention this as Senator Coonan presented this bill. We had some questions about how this works, and being a person who has propane on my farm, the supplier doesn't want to put his propane in my tank. He wants me to rent the tank from him. And so I'm questioning exactly how this would work because of the primary, most of these providers, they want you to be renting the tank and them putting their propane in it. And if you go to another person, they won't put propane in somebody else's tank. So that's one of the reasons we didn't include it, because we didn't think it worked as we were anticipating. So I don't know if there's any more conversation we should have about that. And maybe Senator Coonan wants
Senator
to
Coonan?
Comment.
Yeah, we talked about that, and and I understand that part of the idea was to encourage people to buy their own tanks so they'd be able to shop around for the best deal. But as Senator Skoy mentioned, there's quite a few providers that don't want to do that. And another thing that I think is kind of interesting, at least in my area, is some of the propane retailers actually will provide a tank free of charge as long as you're buying the propane from them. So we haven't quite worked those issues out yet.
Questions for members?
Mr. Chair?
Chair Drazkowski.
Just curious, Mr. Chair, is this an upfront exemption?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I did not hear that.
Chair Drazkowski.
Ms. Dalton, is it an upfront exemption? Do they get the exemption immediately?
Representative Drazkowski, yes, it is.
Thank you.
More questions to the department?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we had watched the committee hearings relating to propane this year, listening to the types of needs that are out there, this seems to be something that is trying to address a problem. And we did notice, Mr. Chair, that this is a limited time, limited provision. And so we appreciate that, to be able to see if this provision is working, and if there is still a propane issue, then that can be extended. So the time limitedness nature of this is, I think, a prudent choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for members? We'll go to item next, which is 13, capital equipment exemption for restaurants. And there should be an amendment. I guess at this point we should get the provision in the shape we'd like to work off of. So Vice Chair Barrett moves the H0848A120 amendment. All in favor say aye. Provisionally. Opposed. Motion prevails provisionally. Okay, as amended, Ms. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the section provides expands the capital equipment exclusion to include machinery and equipment used in by restaurants and now by mobile food units, otherwise known as food trucks, to prepare and serve food. The amendment has no impact. My understanding is the amendment has no impact on the revenue notice that food trucks were inadvertently included when they did the initial revenue estimate.
They were visionaries. Questions for members? Straightforward to the department.
Mr. Chair, did you want comment on the amendment or on the bill?
On the bill as amended.
On the bill as amended.
Provision as amended. Provisional.
Mr. Chair, the capital equipment exemption, it is an exemption that is for manufacturing. I know the case that was made in the committees this year, Mr. Chair, tried to talk about the manufacturing process extending to food. So it's part of the reason why there is an exemption for manufacturing. Typically what we've heard is to try and incent businesses to have their manufacturing facility within this state rather than another state to locate large manufacturing facilities. With food, Mr. Chair, there is restaurants all over the state. So while this would provide a tax reduction for restaurants, in terms of the manufacturing incentive that may come from moving a location from state to state, in that case, it might be dissimilar to that incentive for other types of manufacturers.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any follow-up questions after the department remarks?
I like this one.
Okay, thank you. Okay, item 14, lawful gaming taxes. Mr. Klayman.
The adopted amendment.
Mr. Klayman, to item 14.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be on the side-by-side, page 53, and starting at section 3. We had two gambling bills that were merged into the omnibus tax bill, one from Representative Knobloch and another from Representative Hoppe, and they were merged together because they both amended, or some of the sections were merged together because they both amended the same section of law. Section 3, it does a few things. It changes the tax rate for electronic linked bingo. Currently, electronic linked bingo is taxed under the graduated tax rate of the combined net receipts tax. The top rate under the combined net receipts tax is 36%. Section 3 changes the tax rate for electronic linked bingo to the flat tax rate of 8.5%, which is currently how paper bingo is taxed. This section also taxes the pull tabs receipts at a flat 9% rate if those pull tabs, and these are paper pull tabs, are sold by a bingo hall. Section 19 on page 54 of the side-by-side, section 19 defines a bingo hall as a premises where the primary business is bingo. Otherwise, the tax rate for pull tabs remains the same as it currently is, and pull tabs are taxed again under the combined net receipts tax. Section 4 extends the brackets for the combined net receipts tax. This is the graduated rate structure. Currently, the top bracket is $157,500 in net receipts, and that's where the 36% tax rate is applied. What Section 4 does is it extends the brackets in $100,000 intervals. So the new top rate of 36% would kick in at the level of $300,000 in combined net receipts as opposed to the current $157,500 level. In addition, Section 4 also exempts the first $50,000 in net receipts that would otherwise be taxed under the entire section of the gambling tax statute. It exempts the first $50,000 from taxation. Lastly, on page 54 of the side-by-side, section 18 contains a provision relating to the requirement to submit an audited financial statement to the Attorney General as part of the requirement to submit an annual report to the Attorney General. Currently, the threshold for submitting an audited financial statement is $750,000 in gross receipts received by that gambling organization in a year. And Section 18 would change that threshold to $750,000 in net receipts. And I would also add that there's also another revenue audit that's due, which isn't affected by this provision in Section 18, and the revenue audit The threshold for that is also $750,000 in gross receipts. And that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Pam. Questions for members on the gaming? Chair Skoy?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I've carried this in the Senate, and once I saw the potential to negatively impact the stadium reserve account, I backed away from the revenue changes in the bill. But I did do a fair amount of work on if there wasn't some way to relieve these organizations of some of the audit requirements. And we had a number of meetings on that, and we didn't come up with any resolution. But if there's a solution to that, we would be interested in it. But I do have concerns with regard to the stadium reserve account.
Questions for members? Thank you, Chair Scott. Questions for members to the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The department has concerns about a couple of these changes. Overall, there is a concern about the loss of revenue to the stadium funding plan that was put in place. In addition, we would have concerns about having the same item treated differently, whether it was sold in a bingo hall or other locations. So the paper pull tabs would have a different rate applied depending on where they were sold. And that's not generally something that we like to do in the tax world. If it is taxable in one form, it's taxable at the same rate in another form or another location. We understand and have been taking part in the conversations with respect to some of the administrative challenges that they are faced by small nonprofit organizations who engage in these activities, and are happy to continue those conversations about what information the department needs and what other items may not be needed in terms of the information that is submitted by these organizations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Follow-up questions from members? Item next, 15 veterans organizations property tax reduction. I thought we did that.
We did have an amendment.
Okay. Chair Draskowski, to the 114, I'll just briefly describe it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amendment to the bill that lowers the class rate for VFWs and Legions and Trend Member from 1.5 to 1.0. This amendment, as I understand, helps conform the provision to the concerns that the department expressed in their notes to us.
Thank you, Chair Draskowski. Let's Chair Draskowski moves the A114 amendment for the discussion. This is provisionally. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have item 15 as amended. Is there anyone that would like to speak to that?
Thank you.
15. To the department on item 15 as amended. Mr. Cummings, 15 as amended.
Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee, we thank the Conference Committee for adopting the author's amendment. This helps provide clarity, especially as the property tax system grows more complex. Providing this type of clarity is important. Thank you.
Follow-up discussion? Okay, item next, 16, County Program 8 Working Group Amendment. Do we have an amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think the
Chairman Draskowski.
Mr. Chair, I think the amendment is coming. Senator Rest was good enough quickly after yesterday's meeting to work through some changes, recommended changes with me, working from the Senate's kind of outline on how they do working groups. And Senator Rest, I'm hoping this is what we talked about.
Thank you.
So let's get shape. We'd like it. Senator Restman's the A124 amendment. Provisionally, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think I see it at the bottom there, but did you make a clarification, Representative Fiskowski, with regard to complying with Chapter 13D in the open meeting law?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, we did talk about that. Maybe Mr. Hines can help us. Him and I had a discussion, and maybe he can add some information here to be helpful.
Mr. Hines, the Chair Rest question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, and Senator Rest, we did adopt that, or we did change the not apply to say that it does apply. That's the in the amendment on line 1.9, delete not. So now it says Chapter 13 does apply to meetings of the working group.
Chair Rest.
And then, Mr. Chairman and Representative Drazkowski, then that extra sentence is what is deleted. Is that correct, Mr. Hines?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, yes. Then the rest of the language following that is not in that paragraph is not needed. It is deleted, yes.
Good.
Chair Rest.
No, appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay, to item 16 as provisionally amended by the A124 amendment. Chair Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Drazkowski, I just want to be clear. There was no appropriation to support this. All of this is all coming from existing budgets. Legislative staff just helps, and there's no money for the department to help with this at all. Is that correct?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, correct. It says explicitly there will be no compensation for the members and that legislative staff will provide the staffing.
Chair Rest. Yep. The department on item 16 as amended by the E124 amendment provisions.
Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, we're just looking through some of the changes that are made as part of the amendment, Mr. Chair, and we, as it relates to county program aid, if there are specific things that need to happen in order for county program aid to work better, we would be able to provide any help that's needed. I know our staff has been very helpful with the Association of Minnesota Counties and others. So I know that there are times in which county program aid or in 2013, there was an issue that was related to local government aid that was brought up, and then people just came together and worked together to make that happen. So I see the working group. I'm looking through the amendment, but I also know that there's other opportunities for people to come together and work together, and the Department of Revenue has always been a very good partner in trying to provide the information needed to those types of groups. I know our property tax research division does a great job at providing that type of information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up questions, Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a comment to the members. Recognizing that this formula has not changed for a while, and there have been counties that have been falling off of the program aid formula because the values in their areas have risen. What the Senate did was make an inflationary adjustment to the value component of that part of the county program aid to try to bring some of those counties back onto the formula. I think our proposal brings 14 of counties back into the county program aid formula for that component. But, you know, taking another look at that formula certainly is, you know, appropriate thing to do. But that's the Senate proposal for this year is to make that inflationary adjustment on the value side.
Questions for members? Thank you, Chair Skoy. Item next, 17, school bond agricultural credit. House research will take that. Mr. Hines, you want to join us up here, please? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this amendment, I shouldn't say simply, but it moves it from a this is the house, garage, and half your acre provision, and it moves it from an income tax credit to simply a reduction on your property tax credit or on your property tax statement or on your property tax amount. And so that's, I think, in conforming with some of the things the department had concerns with here. But maybe Mr. Hines can help us further.
I believe this is in the Senate of Senator Cooman.
Correct.
Okay, Mr. Hines.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, yes, this exactly as Representative Druskowski explained, sets it back to being a property tax credit, and the department's concerns were mostly on the side of the how to deal with it as an income tax credit, and this alleviates those concerns without speaking for them.
Mr. Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we appreciate the change. As we mentioned in our earlier discussion of this provision, property owners are used to seeing their property taxes on their property tax statement, and having them move this to an income approach we think would have been very confusing. It also would have been a significant cost for the department to administer, and so moving it in this direction, I'd like to confirm with our staff about what this means, but I can anticipate that it will reduce our administrative costs a great deal, if not to zero, to much smaller than they were when having to move it from one tax type to the other. So we appreciate working with you. I would like to just confirm with staff about the details of the amendment. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Any follow-up questions? Chair Skoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know which staff to direct this to, but does the amendment change the spreadsheet amount on this? I see that we're at about $50 million for the first year and $105 for the next biennium. Do those numbers stay the same?
Michelle?
Mr. Chair and members, it would change the fiscal impact on the spreadsheet only in the sense that it would go from an income tax credit to a property tax credit. So you would no longer find it early in the spreadsheet. It would be later in the spreadsheet, still having the same impact. It's the way that we correct. It would be an expenditure. It's the way that we originally calculated it to begin with, so the numbers are the same.
Chairman Skoy?
Same number, different line on the spreadsheet.
Michelle?
Correct? Correct.
Thank you, Chair Skoy. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up on the initial question about the department is fine with this language, and we would not have a fiscal cost to administer this provision. I'd ask Mr. Ouellet of our Property Tax Research Division to join us, because I think we do want to just clarify about the revenue cost to this item.
We'll go to Mr. Ouellet. Before we do that, let's actually get it before us. Senator Cooner moves the A112 amendment provisionally. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all three say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Ouellet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Eric Ouellet from the department. Ms. Schill is correct that the cost of the credit itself is identical under either provision, but as an income tax, as a property tax credit, it will have income tax interactions. That is, the amount of deductions that people will make on their income taxes will go down, so there would be a little bit of savings by changing from an income tax credit to a property tax credit.
Thank you, Mr. Ouellet. Follow-up questions? Save some money.
Property tax thing.
Man, saving money. What will I do with that? Yeah. Probably ban zip rail, would be my guess. Okay, item 18, assessor accreditation. Now, we've gone over this before, but apparently there's an amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair Lincheski moves the A123 amendment provisionally. Any discussion? Hearing none, all appears say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now to item 18 as amended. Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amendment to Representative Lewick's a provision that he brought related to assessor accrediting. And Mr. Klayman can tell us more. I understand that the Association of Counties and the Assessors Association are both good to go with this, and we're hopeful that it's moving closer in the direction of the Senate position and that they would find it acceptable.
Mr. Klayman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Currently, what's in the House bill with regard to assessor accreditation, and this is on page 66 of the side-by-side, section 11, that's near the top. Currently, the way that the House bill has it is that the current requirement for assessors to become accredited Minnesota assessors would only apply to assessors who assess income-producing property. This amendment scales back that language significantly, and briefly I'll just walk through what the amendment does. It essentially leaves the higher standard in, but it grandfathers in experienced appraisers without those experienced appraisers having to meet the higher accreditation standard. So if you received your certified Minnesota assessor, if you were licensed as a certified Minnesota assessor before January 15th or January 15th, 2004 or before, then the county assessor in the jurisdiction where that assessor assesses property can apply to the Department of Revenue to receive an alternative certification. That alternative certification, in effect, it removes the requirement for that particular assessor to have to become an accredited Minnesota assessor. That application for the alternative certification for the more experienced assessors is due by July 1st, 2016, so there's only essentially a year that county assessors have to make the application to grandfather in the more experienced assessors. That application has to be approved by both the Commissioner of Revenue and the State Board of Assessors. In addition, an assessor with an alternative certification as proposed would still be subject to the continuing education requirements that accredited Minnesota assessors are subject to. In addition, an assessor with an alternative certification would not be authorized to assess income-producing properties unless that assessor with the alternative certification satisfies the requirements in another section of Minnesota statutes, satisfies the requirements to assess income-producing property in that other section. And that those requirements consist of taking two classes on appraising income-producing property. And so that those are the highlights of this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Questions from members? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to make sure I understand this correctly because my concern, and I heard a few other on here, so some of those experienced assessors, maybe some of them that, you know, aren't as flexible or that, you know, might be having some, you know, they might be the ones we're having issues with or some of these small towns are having some issues with. So is there enough steps in here so that if they want to be grandfathered in and don't want the education and want the alternative certificate, that somebody along the line can say no?
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, the alternative certification would have to be approved by both the Commissioner of Revenue and the State Board of Assessors. And I believe there were some changes a few years ago. I believe that the Department of Revenue actually, there's a system for evaluating the performance of assessors. So presumably there would at least be an awareness if there are problem assessors out there, that that information would be available to the Department of Revenue, who would then on the basis of that information, they would be able to deny the application.
Senator Dietzick. Chair Skoy?
I am comfortable with current law, but I was part of a larger conversation, and I would be curious to hear from the department on their opinion.
Let's go to the department. Commissioner Bowerling?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The department is also comfortable with current law, but we understand that there are concerns, and we have been working with the association and with others who are interested in this issue. And I will I appreciate the work that's been done to try to find that right balance between having assessors who make important determinations every day about Minnesotans' properties, having the right level of education and training, particularly as you all know, the property tax system in Minnesota is not the simplest of our 50 states. And so we appreciate the work that's been being done, and I think there's a lot of similarities that to a proposal actually we are putting the finishing touches on that we might be able to come, I'd hope we could be able to share with you later today, that addresses the issue if someone has been a longtime assessor who has had accreditation in good standing, can do something else to try to meet that accreditation other than taking those courses. And so instead of the certification approach, we have been talking about sort of an equivalency evaluation to be able to make a determination based upon data about that individual's abilities and knowledge, as opposed to just an affidavit of someone that says that that's fine. And it is true that the department does, the department and the board both do interact with individuals who may have complaints about an assessor or that process. We hear appeals. But at the end of the day, those are based upon self-selected individuals who make that choice, and it's not really based on data. And so having an equivalency sort of examination would allow for the board to be able to determine whether this person has the actual knowledge requisite to be able to engage in this work. And I think the issue that is noted in here, with this, particularly with respect to income-producing properties, is an important one because those are, of course, more complex. And so we think an approach to get to a waiver where someone who has had a long, good standing record and maintains the accreditation and the courses that are available, perhaps we could move to grant a waiver if they could reach an equivalency of evaluation. So based on the conversations in this committee, the department has been working with the association, and we appreciate this draft. This will help us, I think, look at this and reflect upon this, and we will try to get you some language a little bit later yet today if we can to try to reach some compromise on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what I would like to say is I would encourage you to work with the department, see if there's something that you guys can work out, and maybe if it becomes two against one, the Senate will overcome its resistance to the change.
Thank you, Chair Skoy. Any other questions? Okay, item
Mr.
next.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just two quick.
Is this 2.18?
This would be 2.18.
Okay, go ahead.
First, I'd just like to also say that the county assessor has to submit the application, and so the county assessor would have a role in approving the application for a particular assessor. Secondly, the committee may want to think about amending and to delete Section 12 from the House tax bill. This is page 66 of the side-by-side. Section 12 was initially part of the same bill that Section 11 came from, and it just came to my attention that there that should have or could have been deleted with this particular amendment. Section 12, subject to the modified requirements of Section 11, allowed the Board of County Commissioners, in consultation with the assessor, to determine levels of licensure for other assessors. And that probably is not needed with the adoption of this amendment because the stronger accreditation requirement remains more intact under the amendment.
Is that
so?
Okay, would that simply be a motion to remove Section 12, or should we wait for the department as they're working on incorporating that possibly in their amendment? What would everyone prefer there? Wait on that? Okay. We'll hold off on that. Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Mr. Klayman and Mr. Hines. Okay, item next, 19, and then I have the gentleman from Lyon, with a provision. Chair Lencheski has a couple provisions. I think Chair Drazkowski has one. Okay, so this is for item 19. Okay, to get the provisional in the shape we would like, I'll move the SCH-0848A79 amendment. Discussion, hearing none, and this is provisional. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, 19 as amended, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, both the House and the Senate had provisions related to modular homes. Our Article 6, Section 6, and their Article 4, Section 3 were identical. What we're modifying in this amendment is the Senate Article 3. This is language that was worked out with the House, the Senate, the Department of Revenue, and the manufactured home dealers. So this is kind of everybody agreeing to it. Article 6, Section 4 of the House was language in the original bill, and we carried it forward, although no one was really sure what it did. And after further discussion, we all agreed that it's not necessary, that all of these are already considered to be improvements to real property and not a retail sale, and nobody could come up with a scenario where this would have been considered a retail sale. So we do not need House Article 6, Section 4.
And for the conference, the amendment we just approved, the A79, was to the Senate language. Is that correct, Ms. Bell?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Questions for members? Chair Skoy.
And before I go to Ms. Pollack to help me understand this, I would like to ask a question. Or maybe, so if we're going from dealer's cost to the modular manufacturer's sales price, would not the sale price be a significantly higher number that the sales tax exemption would be being applied to than the dealer's cost?
Ms. Dalton?
Or Ms. Pollack, either
one. Ms. Pollack, would you like to join us here, please?
Mr. Chair, the modular manufacturer's price is the price that the dealer pays. And this has been the issue of,
is it the invoice cost?
Is it the dealer's cost? You know, how do we define this in a way that everybody understands what the
price
is? Can I go to Ms. Pollack?
Yes, Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, did you have a question? I was just going to add something to Ms. Dalton's comment.
I want to hear what you're going to add to this.
Ms. Pollack? Mr. Chair, part of the conversation was that in the sales tax chapter, we use the term and we apply the tax to the sales price. And so the department wanted to make sure that that term was included, and so that there was a universal understanding of what the exemption would apply to. And as Ms. Dalton said, the modular manufacturer's sales price is the dealer's price. And so this just makes the language consistent with how the sales tax is applied in the state.
And thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Pollack. So this amendment is on the House language or the Senate language, and after the amendment, is it comparable to what the Senate intended?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, this amendment is to the Senate language, and so in adopting this language, this would amend the Senate language, and then it would be up to the committee whether to adopt the Senate provision or the House provision in the bills.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if we get to that point, maybe we should contemplate adopting the Senate language with regard to this provision. This is what we just
correction
amended.
When we get to that
point. When we get to that point, Mr. Chair.
Before May 18th.
Yes, but I'm with you. Get her done.
Get her done. Thank you, Chair Skoy. Any other questions for members on that provision? Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I'll go next to the gentleman from Lyon.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. 219 to the department. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
I just wanted to put on the record that as it relates to modular homes, manufactured home, park trailers, and traditional built homes, the department fully supports providing equity in this area. I wanted to say that Ms. Dalton and Ms. Pollack did a very good job at trying to outline the various issues here. Well, I think that the House and Senate has the same outcome intended, that I think the Senate provision now fully sort of encapsulates how to do that. So I think that that's ready to go. I also just wanted to note, as it relates to talking about installation and other types of items that are coming up in this area, that within the conversations that we've had in the last couple days, we've also talked to people about what's going on within the industry, and the department will update its guidance and educational information for our customers in the coming months to ensure there's clarity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A-111. Do we do that point, or we want to discuss it first? Or?
We have the amendment.
I think staff.
Why don't we wait a second? Yeah, let's get the amendment passed out.
I can.
Why don't you tell us what
I
the
can
issue
talk
is.
A little bit about it. So the A-119 is the simply we're looking at in some discussions with some cities from their border community. Along the western side, we have the city of Browns Valley, which sits on the port part of the state that kind of dives into the Dakotas deeply, and they've got some of the same issues that have been dealing with competition from their western states, but also with some of the flooding issues that have happened with some of the larger cities up north, and just this simply extends the border city development zone for them for the potential as a standalone portion, limiting it to about $30,000 so that they can have the potential to develop some competition within their city and their border to draw business in and economic development. So that's
so
primarily what
okay, let's get it so that we can provisionally look at it. Representative Swazinski moves the A-119 discussion. Chair Skoy.
Thank you. What exactly are we amending this to? Are we doing this into the Taylor's Falls provision, or what exactly are we doing with this?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this essentially mirrors the Taylor's Falls provision that's in the House bill already. Several years ago, I think in 2003, the legislature previously did this for the city of Laverne, and this provision is, and the Taylor's Falls provision are basically the same provision that Laverne was given. I don't remember the dollar amount of the allocation Laverne got.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Mr. Michaels. Would it not be appropriate to just add the A-119 amendment to our list of issues? Because we haven't adopted the Taylor's Falls provision. It's just on our list.
Right.
And I'm wondering if, being we don't really have a provision to amend this to, we could just add it as on to our list of issues to contemplate as we're put the bill together. And I just
is that
maybe
okay with members?
In last
sure.
Well,
we could
have to what though? You know, we have other provisions that we're amending provisionally. What are we?
Chair Skoy, very good point. We will put this on our list to consider.
Put it on the list, I think, would be the thing to do.
I think that makes sense. Is that okay, gentlemen?
And we can talk about it more. I just wanted to know where we're
going. Any further discussion on that provision? Let's go to the department. Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, just a clarifying question. Is this 1 year?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, this is just like the Laverne and the Taylor's Falls provision. It's a one-time provision. There's no requirement that they would be able to use the money until it's used up. And that's the way the existing Border City program works. And so sometimes those allocations may be there for a decade before they're actually used.
Discussion? Chair Skoy?
And what's the regional center in South Dakota that we would be with?
General from Lyon? Mr. Chair, members, I believe Sisseton is probably the closest larger city. Sisseton?
Sisseton.
South Dakota.
Spell that her.
S-I-S-S-I-S-T-O-N. Not to be confused. Yes. So.
Okay, Chair Skoy.
Not Mississippi, though.
Okay. Okay, we will proceed to Chairlain Chesky has a couple of items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to move the A130 and just, I might not have this quite right, so Chair Davids can help me out. Representative Atkins talked to me about this today, and he talked to Chair Davids, and it's a provision in the House bill, and just so the senators understand it, Representative Atkins worked on a provision that, you know, there's this list of unclaimed money, and he had a bill to have Commerce and the Department of Revenue work together to notify people when you have some unclaimed money, and that's in the House bill. His concern, I believe, was he was surprised how much it cost. So he would like to amend this, if it's the will of Chair Davids, provisionally, to bring the price tag down of the provision. He thought the provision was high. So if my cheat sheet says that this is what it does. It covers 25,000 of the largest unclaimed property holders. It uses bulk rate mailing for contact so that the price tag is $4,475 as opposed to $2 million. And it requires a report to the legislature in March, on March 15th of 2016. So that's the A130. And again, this is an attempt by Representative Atkins to bring the price tag down in a House provision.
Mr. Chair, can I move this one?
Okay. Ms. Schill, this language, not this language, but what we'd be amending to is currently on the spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, this item, the several million-dollar estimated cost, is not currently on the spreadsheet because it was something that was added as a floor amendment to the House bill, and we did not have a cost estimate at that time. Since that time, we have been discussing with MMB and Department of Commerce exactly what it meant to administer this provision, and it's still somewhat unclear, but to lend to clarity, that's what this amendment is doing to make sure that everyone is more so on the same page.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm so glad to hear Ms. Schill say that. And to remind House conferees, this was added on the floor as a House a floor amendment. And I have been trying to find this provision on the spreadsheet and cannot find it. So, yay. But I will say, Representative Barrett, it's not on there because it was a floor amendment and it had not been scored. Representative Barrett and I, though, have had conversations about someday in the future, you know, there aren't a lot of conferees that are 25 years old. These spreadsheets, they are ridiculously small. You just cannot read this stuff. So someday, I don't know what the difference between a 30-page spreadsheet and a 20-page spreadsheet would be. I mean, it seems the font needs to get bigger and we need to have more pages. But anyway, just a comment.
I agree 100%, Chair Lynch. Chair Rest.
Just on line 111, it should be a plural. It should be, I think, shall mail notices by so-and-so.
Oh, notices.
Mr. Chair, can I add that to my motion to the provisional adoption of the A130?
Yes, so we will accept as friendly on 1.11. Notice would be made plural.
Yeah, the staff would correct it anyway. We might as well do it right now.
We'll help them. Okay, so provisionally moved to A130. Any further discussion? Hearing all fair say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion provisionally prevails. Chair Lincheski. Oh, Senator Dietzek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to point out that so when we mail these out to whatever property owners they are, the top 2,500 owners of property, are we going to mail to, like, the state of Minnesota? Because I've looked at the list, and the state of Minnesota and different entities from the state of Minnesota, anybody that is a city or a county should be looking at the list because they show up on the list. I've emailed Hennepin County and City of Minneapolis saying, you know, you're on this list. You might want to take a look at it. So I would hope that we don't mail it to themselves and that they just kind of go and figure out who should be getting this money.
Commissioner Bowerly, please make a note. Don't mail it to yourself. I think that's official, isn't it? No, very good point, though. Very good point.
I'm looking at it.
And this is an issue I worked on with. The lead's really been taken in the last year or so by Representative Atkins. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, people have money sitting there. Go look it up. I mean, but we should. He's been very strong about trying to get the word out to people so they can claim their unclaimed property. There's some that are pretty nice size of assets. So, item next.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, to the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The department hikes very seriously protecting taxpayer privacy, and we do that because they are customers first and foremost and because we are required to by federal law. And unfortunately, we would not be able to comply with this if you adopted it, because we have a very specific section of the statute that allows us to share information under certain circumstances, and so that would need to be amended as well. We would like to continue to explore other ways to address this unclaimed property as opposed to providing information that taxpayers have provided to us for this purpose. Now, this might be a beneficial purpose. They might appreciate this notice, but they also that's a line that I'm not sure they want us drawing, is when we think it's good for them to share their tax information and when it's not good to share their tax information. And as I mentioned, the department operates under very strict federal regulations. IRS Publication 1075 governs everything that we do with information we obtain from the federal government, and unfortunately, we would not be able to comply with this under those requirements. So we'd be happy to continue talking about how we can address this issue of unclaimed property, but respectfully, we think that the Department of Revenue's information is not the best source to get this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bowerly, thank you for being a resource on that issue. We're not taking any final action on it right now. Your points are very well taken. Item next.
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner.
Yeah.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to point out, so as we were sitting here, people, if they're watching, they should check this list on a regular basis, because I was just checking it, and my brother's on the list, and Senator Rest just checked, and her nephew's on the list. So
how much?
Yeah, over $100.
I'm texting
you
lunch?
Right now.
Tomorrow?
Go get it.
Okay. You're the big winner. Okay. This is a multifaceted conference. We're doing all sorts of good. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A113, and I've talked to the House conferees about this in Senator Skoy, and this is clarifying language about a paved trail in Bloomington. That's a project that's already done and going forward, fully funded. But I'm just trying to clarify some language due to a miscommunication that happened early in the session in the House. And what inspired me to make the amendment is there are references to public paved trails in both the House and Senate bills in the SFIA article. So that's what got me thinking about it, and it simply clarifies that the trail is to be paved.
I will be notifying the committee that there may be another trail amendment with no fiscal impact that you may be seeing shortly. Also, that has nothing to do with this one.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, yes, there's no fiscal impact. This is a thing that's already been done, and just want to, you know, I'm really hoping now that that tax bill gets done really quick here, because, you know, now we really need a tax bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for members? Chair Skoy?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if this doesn't fall into the same category as the A119 is to be added to our list for conversation. I don't think we have another provision in the bill dealing that this would be amending, is it?
Chair Lincheski?
Mr. Chair, the SFIA provisions both have paved public trail language.
Very
good.
So
that's how I thought it might work in there, but I will follow the lead of Chair Davids and Chair Skoy.
I admire creativity.
Let's amend that provision. Get my SFIA in the bill.
Your chances just got a little better.
I think I'm picking up a vote on your side.
Other questions for members, or we'll go to the department. To the department. Is the DNR here?
Mr. Chair?
I mean revenue.
Mr. Chair,
We're just speechless, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. I'm not going to name who sent me this note from the Department of Revenue. But I'm not going to name who, and it says, "You are shameless." I'm going to frame
this. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mr. Chairman, for the record, that was not me.
It was not you. And I think as we have 80 hours left, we will, I'm sure, get even more creative. Hopefully we do. Okay.
We're going to vote.
Oh. Yeah, oh, this is a voter. Yeah. Provisionally, yeah. Chair Lencheski moves the H0848A113 amendment provisionally. All fair discussion? All fair say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I like that one. Okay. Yes, if
so
I just got a little better.
Do I got three over there?
We'll see.
At least for got one for part of the provision.
At least for that section of it.
Yeah.
Okay, item last, I believe, before we go to Chair Skoy for any comments about tomorrow's meeting. Members, it is Friday. Chair Draskowski.
I do have a question on the spreadsheet.
Yes, Chair Skoy, before
thank you.
We go to the last one.
If I could get somebody to tell me, we amended the modular home sales tax to change that language, and I just was wondering if anybody knows if that is the same fiscal revenue estimate as it was prior to the amendment. I just want to verify it.
Mr. Chair and members, I put in a revenue estimate request. I'm certainly looking into it. The revenue estimate indicates that it's based on the invoice price, and so it may change. I'm just not quite sure.
So that might be something, Mr. Chair, that we'll have to pay attention to as we're moving to the end.
That is correct. Any other comments on them, Ms. Templin? Or okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
What about 111?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, one of our attorneys had been working throughout the last couple of days on this. So this was only meant to clarify the word invoice price. It was not meant to change the intention of that. So it should not change the revenue estimate.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Chair Skoy?
That's very good.
Okay, very good. Item last, unless there's anything else for the good of the order, Chair Draskowski.
Mr. Chair, actually, I had an amendment. If I could, I'd like to maybe run it by the original author in the House and haven't had a chance to do that yet. It's related to the ability of the local township board provision where they can, at an annual meeting, decide that that the county will take over the assessing. So there's Mr. Clayman was good enough to address some of the issues raised, but I want to make sure it works, and hopefully we can adopt it later.
Okay, so we'll want to have that on the list, and if you can help us follow up on that.
Thank you.
I believe you have
you just told Senator
Coonan. Oh, okay, Senator Coonan to your issue here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is the extension to the City of Maynard's TIF district, a three-year extension. And I know this today is your day. We've been working on your issues, but if you're willing to consider this today, and that we would adopt this provision.
Certainly. So this would be to the Senate language.
Yes, it's to the Senate language.
Okay.
I wonder if everybody's got copies, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, does everybody have the A77? Okay, let's just hold up a second here until we get the A77 passed out. Do you have some Senate staff that want to describe this, or do you want to describe it?
It's pretty straightforward. It's an extension to the Maynard Redevelopment TIF district. Was established back in the late 80s, if I remember. Yes, in the 1800s.
Well, let's do this so we're consistent here. Senator Coonan moves the SCH-0848A77 amendment provisionally. Any further discussion? To the Senate language.
Yes, we do. Oh, it's not through a provision. But we just added as an issue on the list.
Okay. So what we'll do, I rescind my motion. We will add this as an issue to the list. You want to describe it a little bit further, what we're doing here?
Yes, it's a Maynard redevelopment TIF district, and they were it expires at the end of this year, December 31st of 2015, and they're short about, in round numbers, about $100,000 each year. This is worth about $35,000, and so a three-year extension would cover what they have left to for their obligations. The money was used for taking down dilapidated structures and getting the ground ready. The new development was all private money, and so that's a quick overview of the of what they did then.
Thank you, Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan, is Maynard where that huge Harley Davidson dealership is?
No, that's two towns over. That's in Raymond, Minnesota.
Raymond?
Yeah. Same road, yeah.
Well, that's quite that's quite a place. Okay, so we will add this to our list of items to consider, and thank you for that, Senator Coonan, on that. Okay, is there anything else for the good of the order before we go to Senator Skoy? Senator Skoy.
I think with the fluid nature of the legislative session that tomorrow we should be at the call of the chair.
Okay. So we will look forward to hearing from
and Mr. Chair, we will certainly give you as much notice as we possibly can.
Chair Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy. Just for the House conferees, the Senate is going in at noon. Just so you know that. That's when our session is.
Okay, and Chair Rest, I believe the House is going in at 10.
Clearly, it'll be after any of that.
Very good. Anything else? Department?
Nothing else, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Anything else for today? Yeah. Folks, don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned. Get her done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.